No, it has nothing to do with the noble book of Quran.
Okay, that's
you may just read the supplication or a turaka of prayer, as mentioned by the Imam of the Ahl Bayt, and after the prayer, you just say, for example, 101 times, Astaghfirullah. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for khair, for barakah, and then you, choose the one that looks better to you. Now, what about, so if this is the case, so what is about the Sahara that nowadays is widespread among the people? There are few narrations in this regard, according to which, the Imam of the Ahl Bayt, they have done this for the people in the state of doubt and hesitation. But according to the, many researchers, of course, there are debates and discussions about that, but many people believe that none of them has an authentic chain of the narration. So we cannot say for sure istikhara, the way that is widespread among the people nowadays, is something based on the narrations. No. The narrations refer to the istikhara that I talked about, to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for goodness, and unfortunately many people do not pay attention to this type of istikhara nowadays. When it comes to marriage, they just ask for istikhara through Quran or tasbih. But the point is that, okay, even if that's okay, at least do that istikhara, the genuine one too. Say a turaka of prayer, read a supplication, and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing and khair and for barakah.
And what about the second type, you know, referring to someone to do istikhara for you? Does it have any specific knowledge or something like that? For example, because nowadays the people do so. For example, they themselves might not understand the text of the Holy Quran, or they are not understanding of interpreting the verses because of the, we can say, this butun or deep layers of the Holy Quran. So they refer to some, for example, offices of Maraja or some people to do istikhara for them. It doesn't necessarily need any type of, religious knowledge or not.
So, the first type of istikhara, that is the genuine one, no, because it's about supplication and saying...
and asking for blessing.
Yeah. Okay. When it comes to consulting the Quran and doing that with tasbih, as I mentioned, according to many researchers, we cannot attribute it for sure to the Imams of the Ahl Bayt, that they have done it for the people. But does it mean that this is a bid'ah and an innovation in the religion of Islam? No, because... when we are hesitating, according to these scholars who reject the concept of istikhara, they believe that, yes, we can, what we call it based on the niyyah, intention of raja, hope.
Yes.
We can consult the Quran. We can do that through tasbih just to remove our hesitation and doubt. So it might be a way, but does it mean that it is a religious way? What do I mean by religious way? Because many people say that, is it an obligation upon us to act upon the answer of istikhara? The istikhara is telling me that you need to do that. Is it an obligation upon me? The answer is no. It is not an obligation, because istikhara, in the way that is done nowadays, is not putting you in and is not giving you an obligation.
Yes.
It's just a way for the intention of raja and hope to remove your hesitation and doubt. You may act upon it, you may not act upon it. At the end of the day, it's a way to, for some people, for their hesitation to be removed. And of course, if you're going to consult the Quran, it's better to ask the people who have the knowledge of it.
Yes.
Because whether that verse, we may understand the literal meaning of the verse, but there are some butun, some deeper layers of the meaning of the verses.
Okay.
At least it is better to consult and to refer to the scholars.
And some people might criticize that istikhara is against rationality, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you the mind power and the rationality, so you can decide according to your own intellect. But why, for example, referring and consulting with a text, with a book of the Holy Quran? What is the use and benefit of it? Do you have any answer to that?
Sure. Unfortunately, nowadays, especially some religious people, they go to extreme when it comes to istikhara. Even the scholars who believe in the second type of istikhara, consulting the Quran, all of them, they have said that istikhara is the last option, is the last choice when there is no other way. You have done everything, but still you are in the state of hesitation and doubt. So, especially when it comes to marriage, and for example, a job. You need to do all the researches needed. So if you come to this conclusion that the boy is the girl is a good choice for you or your mm-hmm. or for your children, you have no hesitation. So why do you do istikhara again? It's not needed. It's exactly against the rationality that we are talking about regarding the religion of Islam.
Yes.
So if this is not the case for istikhara, even if we accept the second type of istikhara, it is only for the cases that we have done all the needed researches, we have done everything, we have consulted the people. First of all, the first stage is that we need to think, we need to contemplate whether this job is fitting me or not, whether that person is fitting for my marriage or not. Second of all, we need to consult other people who know better than me, and refer to different people. At the end of the day, if it is still 50-50, you're hesitating whether to do that, as I told you, with the intention of Raja, you may do the istikhara.
That's right.
To remove that hesitation. But before that, istikhara has no validity. And unfortunately, it's the wrong custom among the people that they overdo istikhara. Some people, they may do it on a daily basis for any job.
Okay.
This at least has nothing to do with the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam.
That's all right. But asking for the khair, as you said, blessing and mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is absolutely okay.
It's well rooted in the notion. Yes. And we need to preach this idea.
Yes.
For the people who are, hesitating a lot, they need to this type of istikhara, because this is the way we are told.
That's right.
Taught by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of istikhara and the types and the categories of istikhara.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Days after going to the polls, the United States remains in electoral limbo. Dozens of elections for the House of Representatives still remain undecided, while control of the Senate is also up in the air, as two narrow races are still counting their votes. Just like in 2020, multiple battleground states have had controversial outages of their voting machines and surveillance equipment, leading to more questions by candidates and voters about the integrity of America's elections.
It speaks volumes, and we see these problems happening everywhere. If you ask me, a very common sense solution is to stop using all this technology to vote, because technology is easily hackable. None of it's secure, despite what anyone wants to say.
Projections show that Republicans will take the House, while the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote next month. Democrats are trying to spin the idea that they could have lost worse as a positive outcome, but without definite results, political life is on hold with major consequences.
Going back to George Bush's own first election over Al Gore, you saw that it was in Florida, where George Bush's brother was the governor, that the ballots took forever to be counted in. So all of this technology, the oligarchy that we have even in America, these problems are not limited to the third or the second world. They're right here in America.
President Joe Biden indicated he will run for re-election, even though a recent poll showed that 72% of the United States doesn't want him to run, and that includes 56% of Democrats. Ex-President Donald Trump continues to separate himself from the mainstream Republican leadership, as he's expected to announce next week that he's running in 2024, refusing to wait until after the crucial Georgia Senate runoff vote next month. The latest inflation numbers barely edge downwards, meaning that the average American is now suffering from both economic and political instability. Mass layoffs, which had been delayed until after the election, have already started as the world keeps moving forward, even if America's electoral results do not. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, our democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
È la prima nave.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while 4 passengers with serious health difficulties were transferred to a French hospital. This is not the first diplomatic rift between Italy and France in recent years. In 2019, Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome for consultations after then Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio urged members of the Yellow Vest movement to continue with a protest against the French government.
There is a clear resemblance between the rift that took place in 2019 and the present one. Both cases are just a mere provocation on the part of nationalist, populist Italian executives. This tension between Italy and France is the result of the insubstantiality of the EU's migration policy.
While EU countries keep failing to collectively assume responsibility on the migrant issue, around 20,000 asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea since 2014, while tens of thousands are stuck in Libyan detention centers where torture, sexual violence and abuse are rife. Max Civili, Rome.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000, for example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary, they don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high, but energy right now very, very high. Gas high, and because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really
like worried about the cost of living, and he like tried so hard to like increase the prices little by little, and we ended up like having an argument about it, and he ended up like evicting me because like I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now like I'm paying like a really high price for like such a small room, no like living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits, and the government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I'm often confined to my room. Darkness is my future, although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims. We're left to helplessness and nothing else. And speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region, but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles. Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities. North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aid if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With the increase in the prices of gas, electricity, gasoline, and the intensifying inflationary pressure on the consumers, one out of every six American households is unable to pay their electricity bills. Most Americans do not accept President Joe Biden's explanation for the higher prices of gasoline and fuel, and say he has performed poorly in managing the U.S. economy in general. The U.S. President Joe Biden claims that Russia is responsible for the increase in the price of oil and gas, but a new opinion poll shows that only 1 in 10 Americans, or about 11%, agree with this explanation. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times reports, gas, electricity, and gasoline prices in the United States are creeping higher, reversing a months-long streak of declines and chipping away at a potent talking point for the Joe Biden administration, which had been emphasizing its success at easing pressure on the American public since this summer. Though the uptick has followed a rise in crude oil prices, analysts point out to two new factors that are also pushing gas and gasoline prices higher: a loss of refining capacity in California and Ohio, and rising demand in recent weeks. According to data from the American Automobile Association, the AAA, the national average price of regular gasoline stood at $3.89 a gallon on Friday, 7th of October, climbing for more than 2 weeks. That's lower than the record of about $5.02 a gallon reached in June of this year, but still higher than usual for this time of the year. Prices have made a particularly big leap in California. At about $6.39 a gallon, prices are close to the state's June record of $6.44 a gallon. Gas prices there and in other western states, including in Nevada and Arizona, jumped after several refineries in the region closed for maintenance. The rise, should it last, could increase pressure on the White House to act quickly to bring down prices. A spike in gas prices, which followed a surge in crude oil and other energy costs after Russia's conflict with Ukraine, became both a political liability and a policy headache as consumer prices rose across the board. President Joe Biden, who over the summer responded to the increase in gas prices by chiding energy companies for profiteering on consumers, released oil from strategic reserves and encouraged Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Gas prices eventually started to decline. The global oil prices tumbled amid rising concern about the slowing of global economy and demand eased. The recent jump means White House officials have been pressed to address the issue once again. Brian Deese, the director of the National Economic Council, said on Thursday, 6th of October, that energy companies need to lower prices at the petrol pump. Analysts say the refinery shutdowns will be temporary, and the fact that Americans tend to drive less in the winter months could keep prices from climbing as sharply as they did back in June. But a recent rebound in crude oil prices, which rose nearly 17% this week as the world's major oil producers agreed to cut production, means predicting what's next will be difficult. The Hill has covered the same story, but from a different angle. According to a Gallup poll released recently, the American public's view of the economy are declining as gas prices are rising. 2/3 of the American public surveyed in the poll conducted recently said that gas prices are causing a moderate or severe financial hardship on their household. That figure marks an increase of 15 percentage points from the 52% who said the same back in April, and is among the highest that Gallup has found when posing the question during periods of gas price increases since 2000. Meanwhile, Gallup's Economic Confidence Index, a summary of Americans' ratings of current economic conditions and outlook for the economy's future, dropped 13 percentage points from last month to minus 58. The index ranges from 100, if all respondents describe the economy positively, to minus 100, if all respondents describe the economy negatively. The index's current score is the lowest since February of 2009, when the country was still experiencing the Great Recession. The all-time low was minus 72, recorded back in October of 2008. 8 out of 10 surveyed adults in households earning less than $40,000 a year said gas prices have caused a financial hardship, and 4 out of 10 describe it as severe. Almost 3/4 of respondents from the households earning between $40,000 and $99,999 reported a hardship, and 40% called it severe. Half of respondents from households earning more than $100,000 a year reported a hardship, and 22% called it severe. Aside from the political consequences, a sustained rise in gas prices could affect how businesses and consumers view the U.S. economy. In July, falling gas prices were a key part of the better-than-expected reading of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, offering a brief glimmer of hope to those looking for signs that inflation has peaked. Russia Today has also covered the same story. According to a Rasmussen poll published recently, just 11% of the American public believe Russian President Vladimir Putin is to blame for record high gas prices in the United States. The majority instead blame President Joe Biden. More than half, or 52% of respondents to the Rasmussen poll conducted recently, pointed to President Biden's poor energy policies as the reason gas prices have become unaffordable, meaning the administration's Putin's price hike narrative does not appear to be catching on. Those who blame neither Joe Biden nor Vladimir Putin point their fingers at oil companies, with 29% of respondents suggesting the industry is leveraging the current geopolitical instability to jack up its prices. Perhaps aware that his Putin's price hike narrative no longer holds water, Joe Biden has been leaning towards blaming oil and gas companies for the ruinous costs of fueling up, recently accusing the industry of making more money than God. President Biden has insisted that oil companies are deliberately holding back from drilling because they make more money not producing more oil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently warned that gas prices may spike again this winter. In an interview with CNN, Janet Yellen said gas prices could rise due to the European Union largely halting Russian oil purchases this winter and banning provision of services that allow Russia to ship oil by tanker. Janet Yellen said it is possible that that could cause a spike in oil prices. The price of gas is widely viewed as a critical issue heading into the midterm elections this November. Some 92% of voters saw the rising price of gas, home heating oil, and other fuels as a serious problem in recent opinion poll, with 68% of the American public calling the problem very serious. With no sign of an economic turnaround and elections coming this November, the Democratic Party is likely to be blamed for voters' economic suffering, and both houses of Congress may end up under Republican control.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world. You're listening to me from RIB English Radio and this is Youth Station. I am Beta, a medical student at your service, and today I have the pleasure to have brother Muzaffar with me. Hello brother, how are you doing?
Assalamu alaikum sister.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's the Youth Station for you. Why does nobody do that? They hold back and then they...
Okay, go on, as the way you like.
So one of the most important and perhaps neglected concepts of Islam is Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar, right? The enjoining of good and forbidding evil. Now, it should be pretty obvious that as Muslims, we're supposed to push for good things and stop evil from taking place. It kind of makes you a kind of a superhero. You know, you're supposed to aim to be a kind of superhero.
At all. You know, I'm against that thought that you have to be complete to criticize other people. You know, you shouldn't be perfect because you cannot be perfect as a human being. We have defects, we have problems. It doesn't mean that you have to be completely perfect to tell other people what is true and what is not. When you have the knowledge, even if that knowledge is not that much useful to you, you can actually invite other people through this knowledge. Maybe the other person, you know, would act as a way that is a good way, you know, to work. Any guidelines and morality or anything. So I think this is everybody's responsibility as a human being, not a Muslim only. As a human being to invite other people to good things and forbid them from bad things, actually. This is my opinion about this matter.
Well, that's actually a good point. And it's not one you usually hear. There's actually a hadith where these people went to the Imam alayhi salam and they said, we don't tell others to do something unless we're doing it ourselves. And the Imam actually said to them, no, even if you're not doing it yourself, still tell others to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's a good thing. You should tell people to do it.
Yeah, actually, I do agree with that one. But, you know, when someone doesn't want to do something, you know, they have many excuses, you know that. For example, you are not doing the thing and then you're telling me to do that. I won't accept it because you are, for example, a double-faced person or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We go through the road of judging others because we're going to, you know, inverting and turning the blame to someone, some other people when they tell us, for example, to do or not to do something.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this God actually some kind of natural for him and being. But I don't like it. But at the same time, I think, unfortunately, in the world, not only in Islamic societies, there aren't any good ways to actually tell others what to do or not what to do. I mean, we have to be so soft to other people in a manner, in a way, in words that can be so beautiful to persuade that person to go for good things and, you know, just forbid them from bad things. But we cannot actually do that,
you know.
And I think this is the problem of this responsibility of ours.
I think another thing about this topic is how it's not restricted to the things that we would normally think that they're restricted to. When you think of Nahi Ayn al-Munkar, especially nowadays, people think of, for example, hijab, you know, or they think of somebody drinking alcohol or some other drugs, I don't know, things like that. But
yeah,
if you zoom out a little bit, this is actually an Islamic concept which is a general principle for everything in life. So, for example, in the political sphere, if you're a politician, do you have a duty, you know, to tell other politicians and to try to implement those policies in society which will have a good benefit, which will benefit the society, rather than those things which will harm the society. In the economic sphere, for example, if you're an economist, you should tell people to invest into good things and to boycott those evil things, etc. You know, it applies to every field of life.
And yeah,
for me, it's kind of like, no matter which field you're in, I mean, you're in the medical field, I'm in the media field, etc. Whichever field you're in, there's an opportunity for you to be a kind of a hero. You don't like this term?
No, I don't like it at all. Because heroism is, I think, a level of perfectionism, and I don't like it. It's like you are telling about someone which is superior than other people, and it feels like, okay, if that person is superior than me, what is the reason that, for example, this person considers himself or herself as a superior creature? We are the same, you know, we are both humans, we are both some opportunities, we have both some abilities, and I cannot accept this feeling of difference, this feeling of gap between our levels. You know what? And this feeling makes me have guards toward that person and that word.
There is a level of superiority, and that superiority shouldn't be there, like the judgment. I understand what you're saying there. But if you see some evil taking place, you're not talking about the person. The person might be better than you, but that particular action that they're doing is certainly an evil action, and that action needs to be stopped. I'll give you an example. If you see a woman, an old lady being robbed in the street, right? And this guy's just stolen her purse. Now, if you just stand there thinking, maybe that robber is better than me, you know, you've completely failed. You didn't realize what it was all about. No, you need to be on your toes. Do Nahi Ayn al-Munkar. You know, dive in there, get that purse back, beat him up if you need to, and bring it back to the old lady.
Yeah.
It's very important. That's what I mean by being a hero.
I know what you mean, but the thing is, actually, we know that, for example, when a person is there, when a woman is there, and someone is stealing her wallet or something, nobody actually do something. But I think the reason behind, the root behind this action, that nobody do anything, nobody does anything about that person, is not the thinking that, okay, maybe that person is better than me or something like that. The reason that a person doesn't do anything is the way of mindset, the way of perspective that, why should I do the other person? So, my dear brother, let's go for a short break, then we're gonna come back and go on this hot topic.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are here at Youth Station and we're talking about a nice topic.
Amr bil ma'aluf wa nahi an al-munkar. The enjoining of good and forbidding evil. Evil things happen when the good do nothing. You know, and that's really what Islam is addressing through the concept of nahi an al-munkar, forbidding the evil. If you see evil taking place, if you see somebody being harmed, if you see some sort of flaw which is in society, and you don't step forward to stop that evil from taking place, and you just expect, oh, somebody else will do it, That's the problem right there.
There is another question for me. And there is another perspective of looking at this matter in Asia, I think. For example, you have a special mindset. I know there are some typical guidelines. There is rarely gender. There is many things that tells us what is right and what is wrong. But sometimes you have a special mindset about something, you know. And because of your special mindset about something, you will excuse your action of forcing someone to have the same thought as you by the words of Nahia's monkey or something. This is a part of, for example, somebody's culture, but you don't believe in that. And this cultural conflict will lead you to think in a way that, okay, I have to tell that person not to do that, and you excuse your action, which may not be true, as Nahi and monkey.
I suppose so. So, for example, in certain cultures, they insist on marriage only between the same race. Or that person has to be married, and you know, you have to get married to a certain someone who is from your same society, they speak the same language, they're from the same culture, they're from the same village, they're your cousin, for example.
Okay.
Right? And this is kind of pushed and forced upon people because, I don't know, it's just become a kind of societal norm. This, can be argued, is not a good form. I mean, it's not Nahi Ayn al-Munkar because Islam denies, it actually chooses us to go against these kinds of cultural restrictions and to actually go for, in that case, you know, Nahi Ayn al-Munkar would actually be to say, no, this is not the right thing to do. A person should be free to marry outside of their race, outside of their culture and their
actually, I think there is a misconception here. I'm not telling you about the cultural restriction. I'm telling you about the cultural differences. You know, I think sometimes it doesn't matter. You are better or you're worse than that person you are, for example, telling to do something. The matter is sometimes you are not in a level to understand what is good and what is not.
Uh-huh.
How should you standardize yourself that you are at the level to do that? For example, you're in a situation that there are two people, and you know that from these two people, one of them is wrong, one of them is doing something wrong, okay? But you are not sure about your thought, and you think you are not achieving that sort of maturity to go between two and tell them what to do or what not to do. You know what I mean? As a youth generation, I have this problem, actually. Sometimes I have this feeling that I don't have enough maturity to go there and tell them what to do or what not to
do. For example, two of your friends have had a fight or a disagreement about something and you don't know which one to side with?
Yeah, exactly. And also, there is another thing, despite this fact, that because of my age, for example, I'm from the youth generation. And for example, if I go to an old person and tell that person what to do or what not to do, they will laugh at me. And this is the fact, actually, because of that, maybe I cannot do that correctly in society,
well,
you know?
Okay, well, if you don't understand the problem, then maybe you should go and talk to each party and try to understand.
Nice solution. Thank you. I've got that.
Too much of a cliche? No, but that makes sense, right?
Yeah, so, that makes
sense.
And then
once you understand the solution,
mm-hmm.
then you should step in and say, well, you know, you're right and you're wrong. And I think that you should apologize to A, should apologize to B or B to
sure.
Sometimes you can discuss with yourself, and even that would actually help.
Yeah, I did it.
There's actually a hadith that says that everybody has two prophets, two hujjahs, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the external hujjah, and one of them is the internal hujjah. The external hujjah is the prophets and imams, alayhim as-salam. And the internal hujjah is the intellect, the aql.
Yeah.
And so we can actually actively discuss with our aql. Remove your emotions from it and actually just discuss with your aql, and it will actually guide you.
So how about my second problem about my age? You know, I'm not acceptable that much in society to go and do these actually responsibility of myself. And, you know, their reaction, you know, is somehow like, okay, how dare you to do that?
The best advice that I've ever gotten about this was from a good friend of mine, Sheikh Ali. He actually comes here once in a while as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, when you're talking to your parents, for example, do not try to approach them intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
Don't come with intellectual arguments. Don't bring them logic. Don't bring them proof. Because whatever you say, they'll turn around and be like, you think you know more than me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You have to approach them emotionally. And what do you mean by emotionally?
Thank you.
your dad's doing something or your mom's doing something that you know is wrong. Don't go to them, the hadith says this, the Quran says this, or, you know, this is going to have this problem for you. No, go to them and let's say, Dad, you know, Mom, it really hurts my feelings when you do this because I want to see the best in you. Or you say, you know, that person actually said this good thing about you and I feel like they feel this way about you. I don't know, it's really strange and complicated. But the older generation is kind of stubborn when it comes to youths. They don't like being taught
what to do and what not to do. Yeah.
Man, look at the hadith, right? That beautiful story. That old man, he was doing wudu wrong.
Yeah.
Like he was proper, like he was just like throwing water in his face. I don't know what he was doing. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, they're youths at the time. So what do? They didn't go to him and say, hey, old man, you're doing it wrong. This is how you do
it. Yeah.
Imam Hassan said to Imam Hussein, can you tell me if I'm doing it right? And he did it in the right way. It's really cool, but as youths, we have to be really clever and indirect. You know, when they disagree with something that you're doing in your life, you say, you know, but Mom, but Dad, you raised me to always speak the truth, or you raised me to always be diligent, and that's why I'm pursuing this path, or something like that, right?
I think this religion and this beautiful religion and even the word Islam, which means being obedient towards God, is the story of our life. And always this story is touchable for me, that how can a guideline actually covers all of the parts of a human being life, and that is always so touching for me. And I think there is always something to learn. There is always something to understand from these beautiful stories of history of Islam, I think.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for, though.
Yeah. I wanted to go and move on for this episode, but unfortunately, this is all the time we have for today's episode, dear listeners. So I hope you enjoy the discussion of today, and I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.